From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Violence and chaos, missiles and landmines, and trucks full of Taliban soldiers in advance or in retreat? Hard to tell. The war week in Afghanistan has led to extraordinary developments, and for the journalists trying to cover it, extraordinary challenges. Some reporters, including three killed last week by Taliban fire, traveled in the company of Northern Alliance troops. Others have set out on their own. Among them, the Los Angeles Times' Paul Watson, reporting veteran of 14 conflicts. He's been on the move with a photographer and an Afghan translator, commuting daily to the front lines. He speaks to us now via satellite phone from Kabul. Paul, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
Now, I understand that the combatants are busy fighting a war, but how are they regarding you? How are they treating you specially? Are they cultivating you, I guess, is what I want to know.
Well, the strange part about this is the Northern Alliance fighters, when you get out toward the front, especially when you go to areas that journalists haven't reached before, are just kind of glad to have the interest. They're happy that somebody cares about their front line. When you get higher up the ranks, you're back into a more traditional, bureaucratic, stonewalling, manipulative military machine.
Early in the war, you did a piece where you described Northern Alliance troops performing military exercises and mock assaults that basically were staged for media consumption. And after the foreign press turned off the cameras, the soldiers just sat around chatting and looking bored. How often have you found yourself the target of, you know, a spin machine?
Not as often as you would if you were hanging around a Western army, to be frank. There's certainly some of it here, but it's quite easy to get to the real thing here. It's more difficult to get past the cultural divide. You know, no matter how much time you spend with somebody here, you are a non-Muslim foreigner who doesn't speak the language.
About 2 weeks ago, you reported the presence of four Western men in Afghan headscarves and U.S. sportswear videotaping one of these staged Northern Alliance military maneuvers. When you asked them who they were, they refused to speak to you and they sped off in their van. And your story described the situation and other sightings of these men in some substantial detail, which generated some vociferous letters to the L.A. Times. One reader wrote, "Paul Watson has given our enemy enough information to make these men targets." And another one said, "Get a clue, we're at war." Do you think you compromised some sort of military or intelligence operation?
I have no idea whether I compromised it or I didn't, but I will take the writer's point. The United States is at war, and that demands the highest level of professional behavior on the part of intelligence services and the military. When I saw those people, I can tell you my first assumption was they can't possibly be carrying an intelligence because they're doing it in an amateur fashion. If I, as a reporter, without the slightest amount of effort, can spot them, then an Afghan would do it before me. I can assure you of that. They stuck out like a sore thumb. And my purpose in writing that story was to tell people that if you want to win this thing, you have to pay attention and demand that your politicians and your military commanders and your civilian intelligence forces do it the right way.
This is a week when three foreign journalists were killed, not far from where you're reporting now. Would your mother prefer that you had gone into dentistry?
I think she gave up a long time ago. Look, I photographed in Somalia when that mission went wrong. The picture of the American airman being dragged by an angry Somali mob. You know, I got a lot more heat from people in the United States, including people in military, probably foremost among them, because of that photograph, because people thought that somehow I had intended to denigrate a fallen American soldier, and worse, to undermine the mission there. Ever since that incident, I've been determined to try to be in the place where it counts, because there's really no other purpose for doing what it is that I do here except to tell people the hard reality of it. A lot of these conflicts now have simply become entertainment. It's people standing on roofs, talking into cameras about things that are exploding. That's not the essence of a conflict. The essence of a conflict, to me, that people really need to know about is, what are the consequences going to be? Is Afghanistan still going to be a cesspool of drugs and conflict and terrorism, or is it going to be cleaned up? If people had asked that question 10 years ago and had paid attention all the way along the line to the war that was going on here, I hate to say this, but the World Trade Center towers would still be standing.
All right. Paul Watson, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Paul Watson is the South Asia Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times, headquartered in New Delhi, India, but speaking to us by satellite phone from Kabul, Afghanistan.
Paul Watson says you can't cover a war from the tops of buildings. The Arabic satellite channel Al Jazeera has decided to focus on the street. Yes, the actual street where protesters burn effigies, but also the figurative street, which has come to mean the mob. Al Jazeera has taken the passion and the rhetoric of the street, put it in the studio, and beamed it out to 35 million viewers in the Arab world. At least that's the impression of author and scholar Fuad Ajami, who wrote an article for the current issue of the New York Times Magazine called What the Muslim World is Watching. Mr. Ajami, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you very much for having me.
Before we get to your article, I want to quote from one by Thomas Friedman, who said, if you polled Arab leaders and asked, which would you get rid of first, Israel or Al Jazeera would win hands down. But just because it infuriates Arab leaders doesn't necessarily mean that Al Jazeera offers a well-rounded debate, does it?
Well, Al Jazeera, in a way, it's sort of like in an Arab world where there is the officially guided and controlled press, where the entire press really actually reports the comings and goings of the head of state. Al Jazeera came in 1996 and challenged all that. And I think that is, if you will, the net positive side of Al Jazeera. On the negative side, there's plenty. And there are people who dub Al Jazeera in the Arab world the Osama bin Laden channel. It's what I call all Osama all the time.
As a matter of style, you say that Al Jazeera plays a sly game. Would you elaborate on that?
Well, I think, for example, on Israel, I felt that this was pretty clever in many ways. What they did is they broke with the silly Arab taboo on interviewing Israelis and having Israelis on Arab airwaves, and they would interview Shimon Peres, they would interview Ehud Barak, they would give access to their airwaves. At the same time, there was this steady coverage of the riots in the street and the battles between these young boys with masks and slingshots, and the promo, the main tape that Al Jazeera used over and over again, and there were even Palestinians who complained that this was being opportunistically used, was that tragic shooting of the boy Mohammed Dora in his father's arms in Gaza in September 2000, at the end of the month of September.
You also mentioned that it apes the style of Western journalism,
yeah,
while actually stacking the deck in a very different way.
You know, I'm not a big fan of the McLaughlin report. If you like shouting, Al Jazeera does it even. It outshouts the American shouting shows. And I think in many ways it was bound to be like this, I felt. This is a world, the Arab world, where in 1990, it took 3 days for the official Arab media to report that Iraq had conquered Kuwait. So then comes this band of journalists who had been former BBC people, for the most part Arab nationalists and Islamists. They are ideological people.
That's the thing that's rather confusing. It was founded by employees of the BBC who felt that the BBC Arabic services weren't allowing them enough independence. It seems to be funded by the government of Qatar.
Yes.
They don't need to be so inflammatory to survive. So what's their motivation?
When the Emir of Qatar gave these people the license and when he gave them the subsidy, I think he wanted to put Qatar on the map. He wanted to challenge the other rulers. And he wanted to give Qatar a voice in the affairs of the Arab world. One sly commentator said, in the Arab world, you have countries with satellite channels. In the case of Al Jazeera, you have a satellite channel with a country. And it's become this very, very powerful voice.
Since this crisis began, the Bush administration has been contending with the Al Jazeera factor. Do you think that its role in the current crisis as a molder of public opinion has been overstated?
I think it's been overstated, but Al Jazeera succeeded at this. The Bush administration, they wanted to shut down Al Jazeera. They wanted to shout it down. They wanted to talk to the Emir of Qatar about doing something about Al Jazeera. Then on the other, you know, phase two began the charm offensive on Al Jazeera. So Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld went on the air, Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, went on the air with interviews with Al Jazeera, and then Secretary of State Colin Powell gave interviews to Al Jazeera. So we gave Al Jazeera indiscriminate, total access. And we forgot that there were other media in the Arab world, bigger media, bigger outlets than Al Jazeera. Why single out Al Jazeera and why reward its stridency and its radicalism?
But forgetting for a moment that U.S. interests are hurt by Al Jazeera's slant, what's worse, having no free media or having free media that would, as you say, make the Fox News channel blush?
That's the choice. That's the bargain. Either you watch the staid, domesticated press of the Egyptian regime or the Saudi regime or the, you know, Jordanian regime, or you watch Al Jazeera, where there is, in effect, forgive me, but it's almost like a journalistic riot.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Fuad Ajami is author of The Arab Predicament and also of What the Muslim World is Watching, which appears in the New York Times Sunday magazine this week.
And now a correction by way of listener email. Last week, after a discussion of the new expurgated thesaurus found in Microsoft Word 2000 programs, we aired a little parody that involved a computer voice, which prompted a letter from Axel Pline of AT&T. He wrote, "I found the bit to be very entertaining and also recognized the synthesized speech to be that provided by the AT&T Natural Voices text-to-speech via the AT&T Labs Natural Voice website, naturalvoices.com. Sorry, AT&T Labs, please accept our apologies for denying you the credit.
This sort of thing has cropped up before, and it has always been due to human error.
Coming up, The Man Who Counts Minutes, movies post-September 11th, and what's in Mike's pockets.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
Welcome back to On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. From time to time, okay, once, our producer at large, Mike Pesca, comes on the show to talk about different media news items. And it's a little feature we like to call What's in Mike's Pockets. And he's back now. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Brooke.
Okay, so your story this week is about the consortium of newspapers that went back to Florida and attempted to do the definitive recount of the election which decided the presidency. They spent a whole lot of money to do it, but the story got delayed, and it was pushed back and pushed back, and it finally did run this week.
Right. Over a month ago, Dan Keating, who ran the Washington Post's part of the consortium, came on our show, and he explained that there was no conspiracy of silence around this. They just wanted to have enough newspaper writers to have the time to focus on what the story should say, and they also wanted to give the public enough distance from September 11th so that they could focus on this story, which they obviously felt was important enough to spend over $1 million on.
Okay, so they waited for just precisely that right moment, and a few minutes after the papers hit your porch, an American Airlines flight bound for the Dominican Republic crashes in Queens, and the electronic media is 100% distracted.
Yeah, you're right about that. The story only made one sentence on all the evening newscasts that night. It was mentioned in a lot of the morning shows. You could tell they were gearing up to cover this story. But on TV, once the plane crashed, you didn't hear about the story at all. So it was a really weird effect where every paper that morning had big, big coverage of a story that almost no one in the general public actually noticed. And that's what got me interested. So what I did is I went just around New York and I tried to get a representative sample of what the people took away from the story.
Dylan, roll that tape.
What did the newspapers find?
It indicated that Bush would have won.
I didn't go past the headlines or just the tables. But it seemed to show that Bush won the election.
Who won the election?
Well, actually, my understanding is that Mr. Bush.
Who won?
Gore.
I think they confirmed that Mr. Bush did, in fact, win.
Okay, so what do we hear? We hear Bush, Gore, Bush. It doesn't sound like the papers gave them a clear answer.
Yeah, that confusion probably meant they just read the papers, because the papers were all over the place on this. The real answer, I mean, the bottom line is who got more votes? That answer is Gore. Now, there are other details, like if Gore actually had won his case before the Supreme Court, he probably still wouldn't have won the election. Interesting, and it belongs in the stories, but the papers were actually putting that as the main headline, and then having, oh, interesting detail, he actually got more votes in the body of the piece.
Okay, so you had a bunch of people who didn't quite get the full story. Maybe they didn't give the papers the complete perusal that may have yielded those results. What did you do? Did you offer a tutorial?
You know, I kind of broke with the tradition of the man on the street interview, and I turned it into an open book test. What I did was I brought several newspapers with me. I let them read through the coverage, and then afterwards we got together and discussed. How about I give you two. And then we'll get together and we'll decide who won Florida. Okay?
Okay.
All right. Go ahead. Read away.
And so what exactly did you show them?
I showed them four papers. One was the Washington Post. Headline of the Washington Post, Florida recounts would have favored Bush. Subhead, but study finds Gore might have won statewide tally of all uncounted ballots. I showed them the Wall Street Journal. Headline, in election review, Bush wins without Supreme Court help. I showed him the Daily News. Full Florida recount favored Gore. Study. And then I showed him the New York Times. Study of disputed Florida ballots finds justices did not cast the deciding vote. So the Times headline primarily concerned itself with the Supreme Court.
And so how did the people react to this mass of confusion?
Well, here it is.
No, it would be nice to know who really won, you know?
Yeah, it would be, wouldn't it?
This doesn't help at all.
Oh, this is really, you know, I didn't even catch any of this.
They're not going to give you an honest count. We're never going to know.
You know, you picked out four major media here who they all kind of think alike.
So that make you want to read more or make you throw up your hands in frustration and run away from the story?
At this point, yes, you're right. I'm going to throw up my hands and say, to hell with it right now.
That's
exactly how I feel.
But Mike, the papers did face a very difficult problem. I mean, this election was unbelievably close, and there were several counting scenarios where Bush would have won, and it isn't the whole story to say that Gore wins.
Right, and the papers, I guess, did have a tough time because they knew that half their readership probably wouldn't like what they read either way that they put it. So that's why they were, in my opinion, hedging their bets a little too much. I mentioned before that TV didn't really get to cover the story, but Good Morning America did get to it before the plane crashed, and the way they covered it was kind of indicative of what you saw. I can't believe that they would phrase it this way, but they said, finally, a comprehensive media review of last year's presidential election in Florida indicates that under all recount scenarios but one, the results probably would not have changed. Talking about all the scenarios but one, the one scenario where he would have won is if you counted all the ballots. That's why all these papers got together. That's why they spent the $1 million. They didn't spend the $1 million to see, well, who would have won if they counted only hanging chads. They didn't spend the $1 million to find out who would have won if they counted partial chads. They wanted to know who got the most votes. And here you have a situation where they actually found out that answer and no one knows about it. And You know, maybe history will sort it out, but right now, I don't think the public knows.
Mike, I think you're just bent on afflicting the comfortable.
I just want a free subscription.
OTM's producer at large, Mike Pesca. Immediately following the terrorist attack, America told itself it would never again savor movie mayhem, that we were too irony impaired to laugh at stupid jokes. How wrong we were. In the weeks since, we have stood in lines for the violence-soaked training day and the shuddering fat jokes of Shallow Hal. Films about terror and bombs had their release dates delayed because of September 11th, but now some war films are being rushed ahead of schedules to the theaters. David Edelstein, movie reviewer for Slate.com, says that once again, the reason is September 11th.
I think what it is that there is such a paucity of battle footage from Afghanistan. Here are Americans glued to their sets all day, hungry for something other than talking heads, wanting to see some explosions, wanting to know what's going on, wanting some release. They can't get it. So Hollywood has very cleverly said, well, we have a couple of war pictures in the can. Let's move them up, you know? Now, it's interesting. I've seen one of them, Behind Enemy Lines, which is an extremely old-fashioned war picture, and it really just centers on one guy, played by Owen Wilson, who gets trapped behind enemy lines, as the title suggests, and has to kind of make his way out of Bosnia-Herzegovina and out of enemy territory. And they're very conventional, evil Serb villains.
I can see how Behind Enemy Lines would fill the void. What I'm curious about is Black Hawk Down, which is about the disastrous campaign, recent military campaign in Somalia.
Well, that's what the book is, and it is a great book. However, it is being directed by Ridley Scott and produced by Jerry Bruckheimer. Jerry Bruckheimer attempted to turn Pearl Harbor into the sort of feel-good, go-for-it picture of the summer. Fortunately for all, it was a terrible failure, or a relative failure compared to what it cost. But there's no telling whether Jerry Bruckheimer could ever make an entirely downbeat, non-escapist movie.
But Ridley Scott can.
I don't know. I mean, Gladiator wasn't exactly a feel-good picture, but the bad guy got it where the bad guy lived, you know, and everybody screamed for blood.
Two of the most highly anticipated movies of the season are purely escapist fantasy family entertainment, Harry Potter and The Lord of the Rings. Is that par for the course for Christmas, or is there a particular reason why so much is expected of these films in this holiday season?
I think it's par for the course. You need at least one fantasy spectacle every Christmas.
Can you anticipate the public's reactions to either Harry Potter or Lord of the Rings or Behind Enemy Lines or even not another teen movie, a real goofball spoof that probably would have been more tolerated in less somber times? Or am I just off base? Are things really back to...
Brooke, you're entirely off base. things are back to normal with a vengeance, I'm afraid. I think all those movies are going to do well. I think people are desperate to go to the theater. I think they're desperate to escape right now. A lot of very rash things were said in the aftermath of September 11th. I mean, I announced myself that I didn't want to write any more movie reviews. It just felt frivolous. I couldn't imagine how anybody could see a movie, for crying out loud. I mean, a movie? What's that? And yet a week later, everybody's sitting in the movies again because...
That's the way we're wired.
Because that is the way we're wired. And there's another thing, too. The government has given us permission to escape. The president of the United States said, you know, we've got to go back to business as usual. We can't let the terrorists win. I think it's probably a tribute to Hollywood that there weren't commercials for Corky Romano that says, you know, see Corky Romano, don't let the terrorists win. Or that every movie is like, you know, come see Scream 8, don't let the terrorists win. I mean, that could be the slogan for getting people into the theater. as if people need an excuse. They don't, but if they know that they're doing it for Uncle Sam, if they're doing it for the economy, then there's just no stopping them.
David, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Brooke.
David Edelstein is the movie reviewer for Slate.com. As we heard, this year's big Thanksgiving blockbuster is Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, released this weekend. In the advertising, all of the blurbs have been, to put it mildly, ecstatic, but of course that in itself means nothing. Movie blurbs, like fortune cookies and Pentagon briefings, are always positive. The trick, as Bob discovered earlier this year, is reading between the fulsome lines to discover where the real Thanksgiving turkeys are.
A few months back, New York Times film critic Elvis Mitchell screened the movie 15 Minutes, for which he wrote a complex, ambivalent review. He credited the film for storytelling impact, but ultimately dismissed it for trading in the very cynical manipulation it purports to expose. Curiously, considering his generally negative tone, the movie ads for 15 Minutes quoted Mitchell. Not the part of his review that said, "big turnoff," but the part that said, "fleet-footed, merciless entertainment." Mitchell was a little surprised.
I never thought of merciless as being a compliment unless you're a Genghis Khan, but, you know, I don't work for a movie studio.
That was not exactly an isolated incident. Andrew Johnston, writing about the flop Baby Geniuses in Us Weekly, compared the film unfavorably to 101 Dalmatians. The 101 Dalmatians part made it to the cover of the video box. The unfavorably, needless to say, did not. And the Sacramento Bee's Joe Baltaki saw a movie called Next Friday that provoked him to use the word shameless in his review. Not masterful, not transcendent, shameless. It showed up in the ads as if it were a superlative. Welcome to the world of movie marketing, a fifth dimension of context wherein critics' words or phrases are cut, pasted, trimmed, rearranged, and generally defiled in the name of suggesting journalistic endorsement, whether real or imagined. Elvis Mitchell.
They're put together like ransom notes, you know, a word at a time.
Aris Christofidis operates the website critics.com.
Studio PR people, they seem to be the masters of the ellipses. The best one this year, it's from a DVD of a movie called Immortality. And the quote in the bag is, in quotation marks, Jude Law, ellipses, terrific. Film.com. Now, I went to film.com and tried to find if there was a review of Immortality, and there isn't. What they did was simply to take the name Jude Law and take the terrific out of a review of a movie that Jude Law was involved in and simply put it on the DVD box, and there you have it.
So, yeah, when you see extremely brief bursts of apparent gusto attributed to name-brand critics, it's safe to assume they've been printed out of context, almost always with one or more exclamation points appended to suggest even more critical enthusiasm. Exclamations, Mitchell assures, never show up in actual reviews, unless meant ironically.
Outside of the Marvel Comics of the 1960s, when Spider-Man, even with his thoughts, had exclamation points at the end of them, no, I don't know anybody who uses exclamation points.
Of course, most often, if you read the fine print, you're apt to discover that the critics quoted are not from the New York Times of the world. They're from the KMAX-TV Channel 31 Sacramentos of the world. Andrew Johnston of Us calls them quote machines, seduced by free junkets to studio events where they get to briefly interview stars in exchange for fulsome blurb material. But the movie ads print the raves in big type and the source in fine print, elevating the obscure to Ebertian status. Andrew Johnston.
There are, you know, people from, you know, small market TV stations who are willing to just, like, basically say whatever the studio wants them to say to get their name in the paper.
And if just the right words don't spring to mind, no worries. The studios apparently are happy to provide those as well. Tim Gray follows the blurb wars for Daily Variety.
The funny thing is the quotes keep staying the same. The names keep changing, but you'll always see, you know, funny, funny, funny. You will never forget, fill in the name of the movie. You know, the most fun you'll have this summer. You know, all those quotes, they keep reappearing every year.
A lot of them are attributed to a particularly ubiquitous blurbographer by the name of Jeff Craig of a mysterious media outlet called 60 Second Preview. Craig is quoted everywhere, and he is always deliriously excited about the movie. He loved Cheryl Ladd in Permanent Midnight. Free Willy 3 was breathtaking. The Kevin Pollak Cheryl Lee Ralph vehicle titled Deterrence wasn't one of the top 10 of the year. It was one of the most important films of our time. Now there's a movie lover. So we naturally wanted to speak to him, but we couldn't find 60-second preview, not any trace of it anywhere we looked. We don't even know what medium it is.
I have no idea who he is. I have no idea what he does. I have no idea where he's published, if he's published somewhere. It's a great mystery.
Critic.com's Aris Christofides.
He's very enthusiastic. There is no doubt about that. Anybody that enthusiastic has to be alive.
We had the same difficulty finding a movie studio interested in discussing this topic. We called six of them, and they all declined to answer questions about blurbation. But if the studios have created this parallel universe of irrational exuberance, that doesn't mean there are no natural forces working in their favor. Between the grotesquely twisted, ellipses-filled, exclamation-appended cut-and-paste blurb and the bought-and-paid-for quid pro quo of blurb whoredom, there is the just-plain friendly practitioner, Variety's Tim Gray.
There's a guy named Lou Luminick at the New York Post who last year in March called What Planet Are You From? The funniest movie of the year, and then a few months later called Best in Show, the year's funniest movie. You figure, all right, 6 months have passed. It's like, yeah, that's enough. That counts as a year.
Lou Luminick, are you a soft touch?
Not to my knowledge. I mean, I basically like movies. You know, there are different kinds of critics. I mean, there are critics who are basically focused on nitpicking and tearing movies apart. I mean, I'm working for a tabloid. I'm basically doing a consumer guide. I mean, is the film worth going to see or not?
Luminick also acknowledges sometimes getting a kick out of seeing himself quoted here and there. To him, it's a minor bonus. To Owen Gleiberman, who reviews films for Entertainment Weekly, that little thrill is quite sinister, a sort of ego payola pervading the trade, fundamentally skewing the judgment of even the most established critics.
It's vanity. When you see a quote of yours in a movie ad, it can make you feel important. It shouldn't, because it doesn't make you important. But there are people who really get off on it. And it can
well, how about you, Owen Gleiberman? Have you ever gotten a little charge or even a big one?
Yes, I've gotten the charge. I'll admit it.
For the record, Elvis Mitchell of the New York Times unequivocally denies any ego satisfaction out of being cited, which he sees as merely a byproduct of his labors.
The blurb is just, well, what's the negative of gravy? Whatever that would be, that's what a blurb is.
In any event, next time you plunk down $8 to see the feel-good hit of the summer, make sure you've read the fine print, extrapolated to account for the ellipses, and most of all, considered the source. You might also want to make sure it isn't still June.
Coming up, more bottom-line pressures wrecking journalism, and when TV cut its teeth on disaster, the assassination of JFK.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The media recession has claimed another high-profile victim. Last summer, San Jose Mercury News publisher Jay Harris resigned in protest of cost-cutting that he said cut into the bone of quality journalism. Now Philadelphia Inquirer editor Robert Rosenthal has left following a simmering conflict with management about costs and editorial strategy that boiled over into irreconcilable differences. He joins us now from Philadelphia. Robert, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you very much.
So just how bad was the profit pressure at the Inquirer?
The intensity of the pressure really didn't get very hot until, let's say, you know, 15 to 18 months ago when the economy went down. When I became editor, we actually started sections. I think what happened in the last 15 months is revenue dropped dramatically. Then the issue of meeting our commitments in terms of profit really became exacerbated.
Historically, Gannett has had lots and lots of profitability and lots of pretty good papers, but excepting USA Today, I suppose, no major papers. Knight Ridder had major papers, important regional papers doing substantial international and national coverage, lots of bureaus, and so forth. Can you really have major papers and somehow keep up with the average industry profitability?
That's the challenge. And the fact is that we'd lost nearly 100 staffers in a year because of buyouts and attrition. And yet I think some of the papers we put out in the weeks after September 11th were as good as any paper could do in the country. You know, up until now, we could sustain it. What happens in the future is a legitimate question that you're raising.
Well, let me play the devil's advocate for a moment. For years, under Gene Roberts, and then under your watch, the Enquirer piled up the Pulitzers, you know, and it won the wide admiration of other journalists. But there were always complaints, too, you know, that the paper was a little too big for its britches. Like, you know, what was the Philadelphia Enquirer doing in Africa reporting on the vanishing rhinoceros? Why have such big journalistic aspirations? I mean, you poll your readers, I presume. What do your readers tell you? Do they really want a great regional newspaper with broad international coverage, or they just want to know if the local high school team won?
There's not a simple answer. I think readers would like everything, and a paper like the Enquirer has a long-term reputation for bringing that. I also believe that after September 11th, those values may have changed quite a bit, because the definition of local news, I believe, has changed. Obviously, news of your neighborhood is important, but a story about a war or an anthrax scare or terrorism touches all of us, no matter where you live, and that becomes something that's relevant.
Let me ask you one last thing. Let's say 10 years ago, if you have to put together a list of the great American newspapers, it was a pretty good list. You know, there may be 15 newspapers on it. I think the list is a lot shorter now. Is there any future for great regional newspapers in this country, or is this current crisis marking the beginning or the middle of the end?
That's a very important question and a crucial one, and our role or newspapers' role in American democracy is inherent in our Constitution and our values, and if these things are made tremendously weaker or don't function as well or fall to demands of other values, it could lead to a real potential crisis in terms of how we make decisions and how our democracy functions.
All right. Well, best of luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Robert Rosenthal is the former editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Newspapers are not the only news source whose integrity is threatened by the fiscal acts. It may be worse in local television, where the big foot of the major advertiser bears down directly on the news operation. That's the conclusion of the latest study by the Project for Excellence in Journalism. Deputy Director Carl Gottlieb says that pressure is felt by stations large and small.
The sample we took is, I think it was 107 markets, which is, again, roughly half the television markets in the United States. And what we found just sort of shocked us. Of course, this is an anonymous survey. We don't want news directors to lose their jobs. But quotes, and if I may read a few.
Sure.
Coverage suggestions, on-air mentions. The pressure to do puff pieces about sponsors occurs, quote, constantly, quote, every day, end quote, every time a salesperson opens his or her mouth.
Have news directors reported cases where advertisers have actually tried to prevent them from running certain stories?
Oh, yes. A half dozen news directors singled out local car dealerships and auto manufacturers as the focus of squashed stories.
What about restaurant reviews or grocery stores? They're big advertisers.
Absolutely. Same thing. That sort of brings to mind one station in L.A. that caused quite a sensation a year ago. I think it was KCBS, by, in fact, going after restaurants and reporting on some of the health problems some of them had. That was thought to be very courageous, but if you think about it, it's just the kind of news people deserve.
You were talking about pressure from advertisers. What about pressure from inside the TV station, from sales departments? I understand that sometimes they commandeer some of the news trucks.
Most news stations have live trucks. That's how they get on the air from any number of breaking stories. One thing general managers and station groups have done is repurpose those live trucks. to do commercials. And often they're live commercials, perhaps from a car dealership that's having a big sales push. Often, very often, those live shots are presented as commercials within a newscast. And that's intentional. It's to look like news. And that's extremely disturbing. The last thing you want to do as a television news operation is give the impression that you're fronting for your sponsor.
Carl, I got to be honest with you. When we discuss doing studies like this, we always call them brand flakes interviews, in that they're good for the system, but ultimately indigestible. This is the way it is. There really isn't anything anybody can do about it.
Well, you know what? There is. If you take an example, take WBZ in Boston, which was in last place in the ratings at 11 o'clock when we looked at that broadcast. They had decided to sort of take the high road in that market. One station there had, to their view, abdicated that high road and conceded somewhat to a more tabloid approach by another 11 o'clock broadcast. Well, WBZ now is battling for first place in that market. I don't know what this particular sweeps look like this November, and I'll be interested to see.
There are just plenty of instances of television stations that have taken the high road and have ended up in the toilet.
Yeah, and we're not saying that's the only way to succeed. We're saying you can take a tabloid road and succeed as well. In fact, that's the second best way to succeed. And there's more than just the project saying so or just myself saying so. This is based on empirical evidence.
Well, Carl Gottlieb, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Carl Gottlieb is Deputy Director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism.
At a time when TV news, both national and local, are contending with the bottom line, it's instructive to look back to when it was just getting off the ground. The extraordinary coverage we saw on September 11th would not have been possible if the medium had not been shaken awake by a monumental disaster 38 years ago this week. On the Media, Sarah Fischko prepared this recollection of a few dreadful days in November.
Ladies and gentlemen,
conductor Eric Leinsdorf, Symphony Hall, Boston, November 22, 1963.
We have a press report over the wires that the President of the United States has been the victim of an assassination.
If you were alive and over, say, 5 years old in November 1963, wherever you were, you remember it.
We will play the funeral march from Beethoven's Third Symphony.
The nation heard the news over wire services, radio, by word of mouth, public announcement, and most dramatically, on television. Television took over our lives for what are sometimes called those four dark days in Dallas, the Friday of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, and the Saturday, Sunday, and Monday that followed. And on the next Thursday after that, the country huddled around its Thanksgiving table, struggling to recover. Which I guess we did. But after that November, we would never be the same, and neither would TV.
It appears as though something has happened in the motorcade route. Something, I repeat, has happened in the motorcade route.
Radio was there, and wire services, and newspapers, but it took television exactly 10 minutes after shots were fired to go on the air that day.
Here is a bulletin from CBS News. In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
That began 4 days of on-air improvisation, television's first continuous coverage of a prolonged, painful breaking news story.
It was impossible to tell at once where Kennedy was hit, but bullet wounds in Governor Conley's chest.
There hadn't been an assassination of a president since McKinley at the turn of the century.
Thomas Dougherty is professor of film studies at Brandeis University and has written about the TV coverage of the Kennedy assassination.
So even without television, this would have been uniquely disorienting and shocking. With television, though, it becomes this indelible memory for an entire generation that with TV we can actually experience the news and watch it as it's unfolding in the same existential moment that the news is happening.
The information that we have, this is no time, obviously, for speculation.
Remarkably, it had been earlier that very fall, September 1963, that CBS had expanded its nightly newscast to a half hour from its previous program of only 15 minutes a night. NBC followed soon after.
Newscasts expanded because they had to.
Reuven Frank was producer of the Huntley-Brinkley Report in the 50s and 60s and went on to be president of NBC News.
You just couldn't get the news in. We had been agitating for a half hour for a long time. With Kennedy, the television president, they thought maybe it had a shot. And it did.
And then that day in Dallas came, in quite a different technological era.
A telephone call, that's from NBC's Robert McNeil, who was with the president's party.
There was a little waiting room with swing doors, and I looked inside, and there were two payphones that were empty.
Former anchor and now author Robert McNeil was in Dallas covering the Kennedy motorcade for NBC.
And I grabbed one of them, and I kept it for the rest of the afternoon.
Bob, are you there? This is Frank McGee. Bob,
when I phoned from that payphone in Dallas, they couldn't connect me through to air. And I would say a sentence and McGee would repeat it.
The president is seriously wounded.
Which was fine for me because it slowed me down.
The shot which wounded the president occurred as the motorcade.
In 63,
was running through huge crowds in downtown.
We were still to the point where a camera weighed, I don't know, 100 and something pounds. And a mobile unit was the size of a Santini Brothers truck.
Reuven Frank.
Our remote truck in Dallas broke down, not the television part of it, but the truck part of it, the engine. So NBC for much of that weekend was represented by a remote truck, this big, enormous thing, being towed around by a tow truck.
Obstacles, to be sure.
Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
But by the time Central the awful Standard truth time. Was known, the networks had resolved to broadcast Eastern continuously and remove commercials for the duration.
It was an instinctive reaction, I think. It was spontaneous and instinctive, and for the first time.
There was never any debate inside the organization about dumping commercials from about 2 o'clock Friday afternoon. We knew that you couldn't have commercials. Some people on the money side started to agitate for going back to commercials, and we just threw them out of the office.
By the end of that first day, America was exhausted and transfixed.
6 o'clock, November 22nd.
Thomas Doherty.
The cameras are there to record the coffin being taken off the plane and loaded into a hearse, and you see this image of Jackie Kennedy. Her dress and the stockings she's wearing are stained with blood, and she's, of course, looking utterly shattered. And it seems almost this... a voyeuristic intrusion into this very private moment.
The sorrow that Mrs. Kennedy and her family bear.
By Saturday, a parade of dignitaries was filing by the body lying in state. There were more details about a suspect, Lee Harvey Oswald, and reporters were struggling with the reality of a new president.
Vice President Johnson, President Johnson, I'm sure that many of us have made that mistake and will repeat it.
Nothing could have prepared TV or its viewers for Sunday.
A lot of folks would say that it is the Sunday event that is truly the one that unhinges America ever after, and that it, this is really when the 60s begin.
It was Sunday morning.
Reuven Frank.
And the president of NBC was watching at home, along with half the country, and he was getting bored with what we were covering, and he said, switch to something live, he said. And the only thing we had live was Tom Pettit. Nobody really thought it was worth covering.
NBC reporter Pettit was following the prisoner, Oswald, as he was moved from jail to jail.
They switched, and there it was.
Yeah, there is Lee Oswald. He's been shot. He's been shot.
CBS had had its cameras running, but they had switched to an essay at the time.
They insisted finishing the essay rather than coming to us live.
Dan Rather was in Dallas covering the Texas trip for CBS.
At a time when I was... first asking, then calling, then screaming, come to his life. But decisions get made. That was an unfortunate decision. We turned the videotape right around and played it, immediately so you could say, well, really, what did it amount to? But at the time, to say I was disappointed would be a fast understatement.
Firecracker rang out. He grabbed his side and he said, ow!
Nielsen ratings have never even approached ever again. The kind of stratosphere that they had on that day. Literally 93% of the American public was by a television, watching on Sunday.
Monday, the funeral.
You didn't need to have people nattering on about nothing and just bloviating to hold the airspace There was enough inherent drama in millions of people weeping over their television sets.
What did television learn from November 1963?
From then on, the presidency, it just took over the news. By the way, I don't think this is peculiar to television. I think all news media. The White House Bureau's coverage expanded exponentially. A lot of people felt they had missed the biggest story of their lives. And from then on, nothing the president did or does is not covered.
I think I know before Dallas, I had no idea of the power of television to move people. It's a shared national experience.
Dan Rather.
The closest thing I had known to it was listening to World Series on radio. And, you know, after a World Series game on radio, you could go out and everybody had experienced it and could, you know, could talk about it. But that was in radio and when I was a child. At the time of Dallas, it was television. I was no longer a child.
I didn't feel my own feelings until the day of the funeral.
Robert McNeil.
We were filming. And a man came and sat down and put a transistor radio down, and it happened to be tuned to the funeral in Washington at the moment when the Black Watch bagpipe band passed. And suddenly, all my defenses and everything just dissolved, and there I was sobbing, tears running down my face. There it was. And suddenly it just all poured out.
Television, and all of us, grew up those 4 days among those images. It was a crisis more fully appreciated by watching than by learning about. That's what television could and can do. Jackie Kennedy knew it, even that night in her bloody skirt. She'd been asked by many why she'd chosen not to change clothes. No, she said, let them see what they've done. For On the Media, I'm Sarah Fishko.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers, engineered by Irene Trudell, Dylan Keefe, and George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Michael Cavanaugh. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large. Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
My mind is going. There is no question about it.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.